Last time, Dr. Sandra Stotsky joined me to talk about how do you as a parent know whether or not standards are good. And we're going to finish that conversation today.
The Family Freedom Podcast, voices of family and freedom. Now here's your host, Wendy Hart.
So real quickly, let's go back to English. Tell me, you mentioned literary merit, I think was the, I don't remember the phrase you used, but...
Yes, and there you could get judgments from editors of magazines that deal with literature in some way. I mean, that was why we acknowledged them in our own set of English language arts standards. I had called up and spoken directly to the editor and assistant editor for the Horn book in Boston, and he had asked me over and over again, so what criteria do you want us to use? And I had said, just literary quality, just your judgment on what should be part of our civic and literary heritage, because that was what we were concerned at the time with. So we had lists by educational level of authors' names. By the way, that's something that parents can spot if they've gone through college or high school on their own. They should recognize the author's name. They may not recognize the title, and if an author has been very prolific and written a lot of books, which can range over several different grade levels, although usually a good children's author is not someone who writes a lot for adults. I mean, typically an author will settle on the reading level of the reader that they expect for their particular books. But the point was that you had the author's name would be a known quantity, and then if you, just for the English teachers who love to argue about what titles they think all kids should read, I mean, it wouldn't matter where you spoke to a group of English teachers, they'd all come out with a different list.
But if there you had the author, then they'd at least have their author and they can pick.
Yeah, they would all pick a Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. They might pick a different play by Shakespeare, but they would all pick a Shakespeare. And they might pick a different version of the Bible, for example, but King James Version would be the language of literary biblical stories, and that would start in the early grades because we asked about Bible stories, Cain and Abel or the Garden of Eden, and they said, oh, there are literary allusions to a David and a Goliath in adult material. Up until 1940, there was research that had been done and found that the two most quoted works for literary allusions, the two most quoted works were the King James, the KJV, and which the Puritans brought over, obviously, from England in 1630, whenever they came to Boston. After that, and then you had Shakespeare.
Oh, yeah,
and
of course.
Everyone was familiar with the language of Shakespeare and familiar with the KJV. And if you want students, now we switch to history, if you want students to be able to read our seminal documents, which should be one of the end goals of an English curriculum, K-12, can they read our seminal political documents?
Declaration, Constitution.
The Declaration of Independence, yeah, and the preamble to the Constitution. In order to understand critical works that were written in the latter part of the 1800s, early part of the 1900s, Lincoln's language was very biblical in its style. But this is where you will get those literary allusions. And even Afro-American literature later on was very heavily oriented to the Old Testament stories.
Moses in Egypt would be a very... That would be very applicable, especially through the slavery years. There were a lot of songs
and
stories.
And I just asked them, I said, just give us the names of the most popular, because there were all kinds of versions for picture books, Noah and the Ark.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, all these stories that people, kids, used to be familiar with from picture books or from Sunday school or from whatever source, parents who used to read the Bible regularly, but a lot of writers took the names, say an Adam and or Adam and Eve, the Garden of Eden, and the snake, the symbolic nature of all of this. I mean, all of that is part of the background of the best writers of the English language, because ultimately it boils down to a language that you're trying to teach kids. It's the selections that are written in that language that reflect the best uses or the most memorable uses of that language, and it's the English language that you're trying to get them to read and write as adults. And that's something that we need to keep reminding secondary teachers in all subjects, that we're trying to get all students in an English-speaking country. It doesn't matter what other languages you come in with, but whatever the language of your country is, it could be Russian, it could be French, German, doesn't matter. All that's being said is that it's the use of that language that should be the goal of your curriculum, plus the body of knowledge that goes with understanding what allusions to key figures and events and characters, whatever, what it means. I mean, if someone talks about Adam and Eve, what are they talking about?
Right. Well, Martin Luther King used a lot of, you know, like Road to Jericho. And a lot of people these days have never heard of the story of the Good Samaritan, so they don't know what he's talking about when he talks about the road to Jericho. So we would lose, in essence, Martin Luther King if we don't have those biblical allusions.
Oh, he was a minister, so
absolutely.
He certainly knew them. And
used them quite prolifically.
Even Toni Morrison's was it Song of Solomon, is it? I'm thinking of the titles alone.
Oh, yeah. It's biblical.
So that you have to think about what was the illusion that was being created? What did she want the reader to think about when she chose a title? I mean, authors usually chose titles for their books, too.
Right.
So you have to be able to think about what is the material that these authors drew on that students who are new to this country's language need to know in order to read that language. I mean, if one wants to maintain Chinese or Thai or Spanish as a heritage language, that's fine. But that's the foreign language curriculum, which I spent time teaching on my own in high school, so I understand some of the difficulties of doing that in a country that uses another language
right.
for daily life. But in any event, you want those kids who come from a different language background to understand what they're reading in English and to participate politically, because the language of civil society in this country is English, too.
Right.
It isn't like it's a different language, or you don't have, it isn't like in France where you have certain tenses for literary tenses. I mean, there are a few languages like that. Every country has peculiarities.
Yes, yes.
And you just have to learn what are the peculiarities and what are the major works. So I don't know if that really answers what parents look for.
That's very helpful.
Because as I've said, English is a tough one because usually, even if they say half the works should be poetry or half the works, one-third of the work should be dramatic literature, you don't know what's going on in every classroom. And that's part of the problem. Teachers have a lot of flexibility and independence in this country behind a closed door. And if you've been a teacher, as I've been a teacher, I know you can get away with winging it in different ways behind a closed door. But the test, if there is a test that has to be the same for everybody, to be fair, then you want to have some idea of what will be on that test. Where will the passages be drawn? And I had committees of English teachers deciding what proportion of the test items, for example, at the high school level, should be literary, non-literary, whatever. And I remember the English teachers getting together for a meeting in Massachusetts the first year that they were developing what we called MCAS, the grade 10 test that would be required for high school diploma getting. And they said they had clear criteria that 60% had to be literary, only 40% non-literary. In other words, it would be informational, mm-hmm. brochures or whatever one could read. But I don't even know what today students are being asked to read for informational or non-literary. It depends, because they can
really
choose their
random.
Own stuff, mm-hmm. can't they, in many schools?
In many of them, they can, yeah.
And then the question is this good for them? And I began to look at one set of readings in one large high school just to get a sense, because I grew up, or I should say I was educated when I got my degree, my doctoral degree in reading under Jean Chawl. So I knew a lot about readability formulas, and I was very sensitive to the quality of the language that was being used in a reading selection for a test. And I was thinking, if you're exposed to a lot of informational passages, what are you getting? And it looked like you were getting a hodgepodge, because it wasn't from any one subject.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
like
good point.
Like the molecule or the atom or whatever. It would come from a variety of subjects. And I'm thinking, that's very confusing and difficult for most kids. Actually, it's throwing almost a bomb at them, because they're being given passages from a variety of topics that are not being developed. They're getting a heavy vocabulary load for a snippet of a selection.
Good point. I'd never thought
and
of it that way.
No one has said that that's part of the problem of testing with informational selections. Yes, there's a big vocabulary you learn if you're taking a history course or a math course or science course, but the vocabulary you learn is used over and over again in, say, the chapter on rock, different types of rocks.
Oh, yeah.
And so you develop an understanding of what these different types of layers of rocks are, you know, the geological errors, things mm-hmm. like that. But if you have on a test, one test item that may come from geology, and the next test item, which is informational, comes from math, I mean, this is a huge leap in the vocabulary alone. And we know from tons of research for 100 years that the vocabulary load is probably the most important part of what you need to understand.
And so they're not really evaluating whether or not the student is good at reading in the main topic or whatever. It's that they may or may not be familiar with the topic that the selection comes from. So it's not really even an accurate.
It's likely that they won't be familiar, because it'll be such a hodgepodge of different topics.
Mm-hmm.
And each one will be different. So every time they bounce from one selection to another selection, they're crossing a huge hurdle mm-hmm. that they don't have when they're actually studying the subject day by day, if they go to school every
right.
day in the week,
mm-hmm.
Which is, of course, a different issue altogether, attendance, because I began to think about what happens with kids who miss 20% of the days they're supposed to be in school. And these are the kids who are doing poorly in math. They're not reading much. So you have a lot of problems that a teacher has to cope with. But the original question was, what should parents be able to spot?
Right, right. No,
and
this is all very, very helpful, I think. Just
and they have to be able to see, somebody's got to review the tests. This is something I still don't understand. I sat in on the first grade 4 testing committee we had in Massachusetts, because that's the only way I really understand what's going on. And I could think about all the different thing, kinds of material that the passages would come from. For literature, you could have a whole poem, mm-hmm. and that would be a complete something. And for a story, you might have a lot of dialogue, which is a lot easier, by the way, mm-hmm. than the descriptive passages, say, in a Dickens novel or something like that, which a lot of us, when we read them, used to just skip these long descriptions.
I've been guilty of that.
Yes. Well, a lot of us can, because they usually had a lot of hard words. But then there was an interesting set of characters or plots, and that was, of course, up to the author and how good the author was, so that would carry even the poorer reader along, because you don't pay attention to the vocabulary words you don't know very well if the characters and the plot are exciting enough
to
carry you along. You read and you learn from context by seeing words used over and over again, but you don't use the context because you're not sitting and stopping and saying, well, what does sartorial mean in this sentence?
Mm-hmm.
What are the cues? Most readers don't do that,
no.
And they wouldn't enjoy reading.
No, not at all.
So you don't use the context when you're an older reader. You learn from context. Yes, if there's something around that word and you see the word used a couple of times in the novel or whatever it is you're reading, you might pick up some vague idea that it's a good word or bad word, or it has this kind of a shade of meaning. And if you do enough reading, you gradually acquire the understandings that you need. So I used to sit sometimes with a dictionary in front of me just so I could figure out some of the words that a particular author might have used more than once or twice
in
a long work. But parents can't see that when they look at a set of standards. It might say, you know, use a different genres so that the student begins to understand how to understand the idea of a theme. And that's tough. I remember always thinking, when the English teacher started talking about what's the theme of this work, whatever the work was, that was the meaning of the work. And that was where you wanted group discussion so you could get everybody's ideas about what was the meaning. Oh, and English teachers love stuff like that.
See, you just taught me something. I didn't know that that's what theme meant.
Well, theme is the meaning of something. It's typical of literature, but you don't have a theme in informational writing.
No.
You have the author's purpose.
Right.
You have a purpose. But you don't know what Tolstoy's purpose was in writing War and Peace. At least I never learned what his purpose was. But there was a theme there that you could, or maybe more than one theme.
Right.
There might be multiple themes, and they might be at cross purposes with each other. But theme was like the meat of the whole thing.
Yeah.
You had to be able to identify what the meaning of a selection was. And if all you've given the kids is a little snippet with dialogue, they may not be able to figure out the meaning of a larger piece. So the test is something that this gets back to. Parents can't see the tests that are being made based upon the English language arts standards, so they have a harder time with English language arts. What they can see is whether, and this is something I've tried to work out for myself, because this is a question that often comes up, Wendy, and that is, what do you look for in a high school set of courses 9 through 12 so that you know that you've got a rigorous high school sequence? Well, there are 4 major types of literature. At least I go along with that because it's easy to use. So there's dramatic literature, which means plays. Is there something about soliloquies or whatever is specific to dramatic literature, asides, you know, stage directions. When you read a play, there are certain things you have to understand as conventions. And those are the things that a teacher would be teaching. So you want to see, are the kids being asked to read, say, dramatic literature every year from 9 to 12? Are they being asked to read fiction, works of the imagination, which could be dramatic literature too?
Mm-hmm.
But to divide everything into imaginative literature or informational literature is collapsing it too much.
Mm,
but parents could look to see, do you have a sequence for dramatic literature, a sequence for poetry, a sequence for fiction, and a sequence for nonfiction? Because there are different kinds of arguments. All nonfiction is not an argument. Some
mm-hmm.
of it is like what's the label on your medicine bottle is not an argument.
No.
You've got to be able to read it. It's informational.
Mm-hmm.
And you do have to read it correctly. You can't make up what's there.
Yeah.
I used to say this was during the height of the reader response time. I don't know if you were teaching at that time.
Uh-uh.
And there were a lot of English PhDs who were very upset with the reader response movement as they saw it, where, you know, if the story was about a doctor and the child said, this is a story about a social worker, then this was fine as far as that was their response. They were going to call the person in the story a social worker, not a doctor, because that was their response to whatever was there. And that isn't how English teachers are trained.
Right.
They can't make up anything they want.
Mm-hmm. No, that's excellent.
So you had, you read a label on a medicine bottle for exactly what it says, and you do exactly what it says. You can't.
Or there are consequences.
Call one medicine something else, and be happy with it.
Right. So I liked, just to reiterate, I liked what you said about the goal of English is to allow children to grow up and as adults be able to function in society, being able to read and write and speak in English and use the conventions. And you said it better than I did. How did you say it, if you can remember?
You want children to be able to use that language as participating citizens in a democracy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, ultimately, that was what I saw. I grew up in a very small town high school in New England, and the idea was that when you graduated from high school, you could participate in town meeting, because every town had a town meeting.
Town meeting.
And that was the idea. You learned, and half the students had come from immigrant homes where their home language was different from the language of the school. But the school language was important because you were going to participate in a town meeting with people who spoke dozens of other languages.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to be able to speak the language of civil or civic discourse, let me put it that way.
Right, to communicate with your fellow citizens.
And that would be true anywhere in the country.
Mm-hmm.
The major documents for our government are in English. So you want kids to understand the nature of the country they're living in, how they can participate, what they need to know to be effective citizens. All that was something we had to learn. And the town meeting was considered, the reflection of a democratic society. Anyone could go to town meeting.
Mm-hmm.
There was no literacy test.
Right, right.
You raised your hand and that was it.
And you could comment. That's excellent. Any last thoughts before I let you go?
And well, writing. We haven't talked about writing.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a tough one because unless you see samples of writing in your language arts document, what do you know about what the teacher is doing? If there's a lot of standards on writing, as much as you might have standards on reading, then there's too much writing going on. And I used to say to audiences that had a lot of teachers, I said, what's the key to good writing? And any experienced teacher knows that good writing will reflect good reading.
Mm-hmm.
It may not, you may not become a good writer. Not everyone becomes a good writer. But those people who become good writers are almost always good readers. So you want, if anything, a bias to a lot of reading, because how do you recognize a good sentence? Only if you've read the good sentences over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So you want a lot of reading going on, and then the writing that the teacher does, any kind of writing, that's up to how much time the teacher's going to have for making comments on student writing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I began to notice recently when I look at what people talk about for writing standards. I don't see any examples of the teacher's response to student writing. And if you don't have a response to the writing, how is the student going to learn whether they've got to do better with an opening or a closing or develop the idea, the controlling idea?
Mm-hmm.
That may be the purpose of the piece of writing.
That's excellent.
And parents should see whether their children are being asked to make sure that the purpose for the piece is being clarified in whatever writing they're doing.
Oh, yeah.
They've got to have a controlling idea if they're going to start doing essay writing of some kind.
Mm-hmm. Why are we doing this?
Oh, yeah. What is the purpose of this piece of writing?
Mm-hmm.
It's the writer's purpose, but when the reader reads what a writer has written, the first thing they've got to find out, which is, and here we're speaking as teachers reading student writing, what was the purpose of this piece of writing by the student?
Mm-hmm.
If you can't figure out what the purpose for the piece of writing was, well, you don't even know how to begin to respond to it, correct it. So parents can look to see whether students are being asked to make sure that the purpose for the piece of writing is clear to the reader. I'll tell you that if you gather together English teachers with a lot of experience in a good high school with a range of kids, so that you're dealing with teachers who had to teach demanding works,
mm-hmm.
and they always made sure we had a range of English teachers like that, I would learn so much from their observations, because they would look at the test questions, multiple choice even, and they would look at the options and they would say, I've never had a child in 25 years who's ever thought this way.
Mm-hmm.
But I have had many children who think this way, and this would be an option. It's not the right answer, but this would be something that a careless reader might do. I mean, they remember the problems their kids and their students have had.
You are a complete wealth of information. We could probably talk for about 3 more hours. Thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
This has been the Family Freedom Podcast with Wendy Hart. Follow this podcast, share with your friends and neighbors, and add to the Voices of Family and Freedom.